in this passage from 1 Samuel, where we will look into the marvelous relationship that existed between David and Jonathan. Now, let's recall that we're back at 1000 BC approximately, and we're watching as God trains David for the kingship that is soon to be his. We're watching as God moves David from the sheepfold to the throne and observing what kinds of techniques God uses in David's life as God, having seen that David has the heart to be his servant and his king, what sorts of things God employs in order to be able to mature his man and make him fit to wear the crown. We looked at the battle between David and Goliath the last time, and we saw that Saul was defeated because he was no longer God's man. David was raised up because where Saul failed, David fought only with God's weapons, in God's place, in God's time, and in God's strength. We saw then that God reaches down and chooses his mighty men and women from the ranks of the quietly obedient, and that God's mighty victories are won not on the battleground, but on the training ground. Now this morning, we're going to begin to see what happens in David's life as he is hauled into court. Now this is not the kind of court that we would normally expect to see if we were guilty of speeding on I-10. This is the court of Saul the king. The story is unfolded in chapters 18, 19, and 20. And because it's quite long, hadn't planned to read it, I'm just going to tell you briefly the synopsis of what happens in 18, 19, and 20. We'll read some selected passages and then see what we can learn from them. David moves into Saul's court at Saul's invitation because his fame as the killer of Goliath has spread throughout all of Judah. David becomes Saul's harp player or lute player. When Saul has these fits of depression, David plays the harp and soothes Saul's savage breast. He is made an officer and put in command of 1,000. I guess that's roughly the equivalent of being a colonel in the army. And he wins great success in various battles against the Philistines, to the point that the women begin to sing of his prowess, particularly as compared with the lesser prowess of Saul. Saul, of course, becomes immediately very jealous about that and hatches a plot to kill David. The plot involves his sending him out into battle, ostensibly to earn great honors in order that he might be worthy of the hand of Saul's daughter in marriage, but really Saul hopes that he will be killed in the battles against the Philistines. Instead, David wins still greater victories, and Saul becomes even more insanely jealous, and his rage turns murderous. On two occasions, Saul actually hurled a javelin at David in an attempt to kill him. Chapter 18, verse 10 speaks of that, where it says, Saul becoming very angry because he had heard the women sing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s and to me only thousands. What more is left than that he have the kingdom? And then a marvelous verse that says, and Saul eyed David from that day forward. You can just tell he put the old eyeball on him. I'm watching every move you're going to make, Saul says. Then on the morrow, an evil spirit rushed upon Saul, an evil spirit from God. He raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, and as he did day by day, Saul had his spear in his hand. Apparently he was using a javelin for a scepter in those days. And Saul cast the spear, for he thought, I'll pin David to the wall. But David evaded him twice. Being nimble, he was able to duck out. Well, through all of this, Jonathan, who had become a friend of David, Jonathan being the son of Saul, the next in line to be the king, the crown prince, Jonathan was attempting to intervene and to reconcile David and Saul. And on a number of occasions, he did that. One particularly poignant one is recorded in 19, verses 4 and 5. Jonathan came to Saul and spoke well of David to Saul his father, and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have been of good service to you. For he took his life in his hand, and he slew the Philistine. Speaking, of course, of Goliath. He slew the Philistine, and the Lord wrought a great victory for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause? And Saul was pierced to the heart by the plea of his son, and he recanted and said, I won't try to kill him anymore. Have him come back. He was used to living in the palace by this time. Have him sit at table and join us again for meals. But it didn't last very long. Before long, Saul's jealousy welled up. He tried to kill him again. David had to flee for his life. And Saul went to him and said, come back one more time. David said, no deal, man. I mean, the javelins are flying too thick and fast in that hall to suit me. And the next time I might stumble and he might just pin me to the wall. So he said, instead of that, Jonathan, you go back and let's run a test on your father. Run a little swab on him and see whether he really intends to continue his murderous ways or whether he really wants me back. Tell him I've gone down to Bethlehem to sacrifice with my family for the Feast of the New Moon when he notices that I'm not at the table where I'm supposed to be, and see what his reaction is. If his reaction is, well, that's fine, tell him to be sure and come back the next time he's in town, then I'll know that things are all right. But if he is angry with you, then I will know that we are finally ruptured forever. Well, Jonathan does that, and there's a banquet at which Jonathan puts it to his father that David has gone to be with his family. And that's recorded in chapter 20, verses 30 through 34, where before Jonathan has said, David is not here, Father, because he's gone to be with his family, and for this reason he has not come to the king's table. And this is Saul's reaction. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. He's cursing Jonathan's mother. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? As long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. See, that's what Saul is concerned about, that David is going to horn in and take the kingship away from Jonathan. Send and fetch him to me, for he shall surely die. And then Jonathan answered Saul, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul cast his spear at him to smite him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. See, that was King Saul's guaranteed diet program. You begin to hurl these javelins around, nobody's going to eat. You lose 20 pounds in the first week. Well, Jonathan then went and told David that there was no hope of reconciliation, and Jonathan and David parted in a beautiful, in a moving passage recorded in a little later on. We won't take time to read that. David then was 10 years a fugitive. He had gone from being a shepherd to being a giant killer to being the favorite at court to being an outlaw in the wilderness of Judea. And for 10 years, God drilled him and he skilled him in the wilderness under extraordinarily difficult conditions. During this time, of course, David wrote many of his most beautiful psalms. Now, we might say, looking for ways to sort of visualize this, that David moved from the boot camp of the hillsides of Judea to the OCS of the wilderness. He had come from being a shepherd to being a king in training, and this that we're looking at today is sort of a transition passage, because David has moved out of the moonlight on the hillsides into the limelight of the great fame that was his after he had killed the giant Goliath. We know that we're always more tested by our successes than we are by our failures. Someone had said there are 10 who can stand adversity for every one who can stand prosperity. God knows that, and he knows that there is an aftermath, a morning after in David's life, and he's preparing to protect him from that. David's son Solomon wrote in the Proverbs, a man is tested by the praise he receives. Learning from mistakes in business, I have found, is relatively easy, even though we commit the same mistakes over again sometimes. But learning from success is much more difficult. And the reason, of course, for that is we get praise when we're successful. And the praise causes us to be self-satisfied. And the self-satisfaction causes us to lose our perspective. We think that we're the ones that are doing it and not God. I heard a doctor say one time that man is a very strange creature. You pat him on the back and his head swells up. And God certainly understands that. And he knew that to be the case in David's circumstance. And so God implemented his guaranteed, genuine, 24-carat, solid gold, humility, restoration program with David. And he has the same program for us So we'll look at it and see what we can learn from it. Now, the way God implements the program, of course, is to move us from where we are to where He wants us to be, to change what we're doing from what we want to do to what God wants us to do. I read an article in the National Geographic not so long ago on how fine swords are made in Japan. The famous samurai swords are still being made by one particular craftsman group there using the techniques centuries old. And of course, they take marvelously fine steel to begin with. They heat it until it's white hot. They pound it on an anvil, folding it over against itself. Then they plunge it in ice water, causing the metal to heat, contracting and expanding with the heat and the cold. Then they put it back in the heat, pound it again, and work it over and over like this. And what they're doing is building a tempered blade. And the result is that they have a blade that is very tough, very flexible, and not brittle. It's not something that's going to break under hard use. It keeps its cutting edges through years and years of difficult service. Now, some of us in Houston today understand what that is like, because we can say, God is either burning me up or freezing me to death, and in between He's pounding the daylights out of me. But He's doing that for a reason, of course, and the reason is He's forging us who are willing to be forged into divine instruments. Strong, tough, flexible, reliable, won't break under strain, and able to keep on doing God's job year after year. Now, by the way, God moved David into the wilderness to steal him, and we'll see some more about that the next time around. Just like He moved Christ into the wilderness in order that He might be tested and tempted. Sometimes, however, if God isn't moving you around physically, don't relax your guard. Sometimes God moves the wilderness to you. See, we've got some wilderness going on right here in Houston in 1986, as many of us could attest. Well, how does this humility restoration program work, and how is it that God protected David from the perils of success and kept him into balance? The whole three chapters really resolves itself into just two things. God sent him an enemy, and God sent him a friend. He sent him an enemy to break his will. He sent him a friend to sustain his spirit. He sent him an enemy who hates him because. He sent him a friend who loves him in spite of. He sent him an enemy to knock him down and a friend to pick him up. Like a hand pump on a well, it takes an upstroke and a downstroke to bring the water. Like a golf swing, it takes the backswing in order to provide the power for the downswing, and the two of them work together to produce balance and rhythm. So it is with the enemy and the friend. Let's look at the enemy, then we'll look at the friend. First, the enemy. What kind of enemy was it? Well, a pretty high-class enemy, the king himself. The king waxed exceedingly wroth, as they would say, against David. 18:6-9, as they were coming home, when David returned from slaying the Philistine, the women came out of the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul. Notice they're meeting King Saul with this song. And the song that they're singing, David has slain his thousands, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his tens of thousands. Saul's reaction to that, Saul was afraid of David, 18:12, because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. And then finally that leads to 19:1, where it says, Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. Now, of course, we would say today that Saul is clearly a paranoid, schizophrenic, manic, depressive. He has all of the earmarks. I looked up in Webster's what that means, and let me tell you what that means. A manic depressive is one in which, having observed him, you see excitement of psychotic proportions manifested by mental and physical hyperactivity, like hurling javelins. Loss of control over emotional, nervous, or mental processes. Cerebral excitement. Manifest in delusions, incoherence, and frenzy, alternating mania and depression. That describes Saul to a T. So that's what he is. A paranoid, schizophrenic, manic, depressive. We would say that he doesn't have all of his oars in the water. Elevator doesn't go to the top. Not playing with the full deck. We'd look at him and say, man, you are crazy. And that's what he was. He had driven himself insane with jealousy because he saw himself slipping and he saw David rising. Now, of course, he became guilty of the same sin that we find the very first murderer was guilty of, Cain himself. If we study that passage in Genesis, we discover exactly the same progression. First comes jealousy. Then comes resentment. Resentment, once it's nurtured, works its way into anger. Anger, once it's carefully cultivated, becomes rage, and rage becomes murder. And if we were to have the time to compare these two passages, they're marvelously parallel with one another, we would discover that this happens when we don't accept God's provision for handling resentment and jealousy and finally anger. You remember what Paul said to the Ephesians? Don't let sun go down on your anger, and thus what? Give no opportunity to the devil. How are you doing in that department this morning? Is there anybody for whom you have a particular little place in your mind and in your heart where you've nurtured and nourished very carefully a precious grudge? Someone to whom you could say, as a friend of mine said to me the other day, I have forgiven it, but I'll never forget it. We just love to hold on to it. And the holding on is what produces the resentment, produces the anger, finally the rage, and then the murder. Does it occur to you that there's so many things in which we see them as just little peccadilloes, things that don't really matter? God sees them as being terribly important. We open ourselves to being seized, Paul would say, by a terrible dark power if we don't deal with these things in our lives. Well, what did Saul's hatred do for David? Saul's hatred, first of all, showed him his opposite bank. We're like rivers in that on one side we have friends, on the other side enemies, and those keep us straight. They're vital because they show us how far we have to go, don't they, in really loving, in really living up to the commandment that we should love our enemies. David's enemy was that way, showed him his opposite bank. It also forced him to focus. David's enemy forced him to focus, and the focus that he was forced to see was that God sends us enemies who have the same sins and the same reprehensible weaknesses and qualities which we abhor, which we have in ourselves. Did you notice here, and did you hear the echo, that the great sin of Saul, I've told you about it, I'll look at it with you at 18:25. Saul said, the king desires no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Go out and kill Philistines and bring me that for a marriage present, that he may be avenged on the king's enemies. And Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Just a trick to try to kill him. Can you hear the echo? What happens in David's life when he falls for Bathsheba? He sends Bathsheba's husband Uriah out on exactly the same kind of mission, except in David's case, he succeeds. Saul wasn't able to get David killed, but David got Uriah killed. I wonder if David heard that after he had committed murder, if he said, good God, the same thing that Saul tried to do to me, I just did to Uriah the Hittite. Well, God sends those kinds of circumstances because they force us to focus. Of course, then finally, David saw him and his friends and something. How did he do here? Seems impossible that he might do that. Well, do you know how he did it? If you turn over to 1 Samuel 31 and read verses 1 through 2, you'll see, this is the end of the story after David and Jonathan have parted for the last time. The Philistines fought against Israel. The men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan. You see, Jonathan did not desert his father, his poor, desolate, helpless, crazy father. Jonathan knew he was wrong, but he stood by him. But he never betrayed his friend either. He harmonized the conflicting loyalties. How? By sacrificing himself. See, that's what Sheila was talking about this morning. It's self-sacrifice that creates the bridge. We learned that from Christ's own life. Self-sacrifice is what harmonizes apparently conflicting loyalties. The second thing that struck me about Jonathan's friendship with David was that he saw a need and he met it. He saw a need and he met it. Saul took him that day, would not let David return to his father's house. This is 18:3. And then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him, gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow and his girdle. That's the picture, isn't it, of the crown prince laying aside his majesty for the benefit of someone else, self-sacrificing, laying aside all of his prerogatives, giving up symbolically as well as in reality his rights to the throne. Because if you were to read some of the later conversations between David and Jonathan, Jonathan says to him, "You are to be the next king. Don't fear. My father will not take your life. God will protect you, for you are to be the next king." This is the man who was in line himself for the throne. Seeing in David's life the hand of God at work, he voluntarily laid his own royalty aside. Why did he do that? Well, as is often the case in the Old Testament, the clue is in his name. What does the name Jonathan mean? It means the Lord has given. Jonathan means the Lord has given. Jonathan knew that everything he had was a gift from God to be used only as God directed. None of this was his. The Lord has given. He also knew, because he had discernment, that God was at work in David's life, and he rejoiced in that. Look at 19:5. 19:5, when he's speaking to his father, he says, "David took the life of his own life in his hand, slew the Philistine, and the Lord wrought a great victory for all of Israel." Jonathan knew that God was at work in David's life. So having seen that, he rejoiced on David's account, even though he saw that God was doing this work in David's life at Jonathan's expense. It was Jonathan who was being set aside in order that David might ascend to the throne. Does that remind you of John the Baptist? Do you remember what he said when his disciples came to him? He said, "Hey man, this guy Jesus is baptizing more guys than you are. We're running out in a baptizing race here. We're getting put down. We're going to have to start working earlier and staying up later." And John said, "Oh no, man, you got it wrong. See, he must what? Increase, and I must diminish." That's the servant's view of his own ministry. Can you appreciate greatness in others without yourself feeling inferior? Can you rejoice when someone else succeeds when you yourself are not succeeding? How are you doing in this job climate if you lose your job and your co-worker, who you really don't think in your heart has the same qualifications that you have, is not laid off? See, Jonathan was one of those who could set himself aside. David Merrick, the Broadway producer, said something very interesting in the New York Times not so long ago. Someone said, "You've been terrifically successful, Mr. Merrick." And he said, "Yes, I know. I know. I've been wonderfully successful. But," he said, "it's not enough that I should succeed. Others must fail." See, that's the human view. The human view. Jonathan's view, the divine view, is others must succeed even if it's at my expense. Well, what did his love do for David? Let's just tick those off quickly here as we go into our closing moments. It's clear that first Jonathan laid aside his majesty. Let's make another list on the side of what God is teaching David through what Jonathan does. So if you think in terms of what Jonathan did on one side of the list and what qualities of Christ-like character God is building into David's life as a result of what Jonathan did, you'll have it. The first thing we see is that he laid aside his majesty. Jonathan voluntarily laid aside his majesty. Well, God is building humility, of course, into David, teaching him the value of humility. Second, he stood up for David, for his friend David, before his father the king, when it was very unpopular and maybe even fatally so to do that. Well, he's, of course, teaching him the importance of courage and of loyalty. Third, he sacrificed himself in love for his friend. Well, he's teaching him the value of a warm, gentle, generous, and giving spirit. Fourth, Jonathan was always attempting to bring reconciliation and healing between his father and his friend. Well, that of course showed him that Jonathan himself was exemplifying righteousness, right standing before the king. And then finally, great encouragement. There's a beautiful passage, 23:16, in which Jonathan and David meet for the last time. I suspect that David knows that Jonathan will ultimately go to his death because of his refusing to turn his back on his father, because he knows that that his father himself is going to be killed. 23:16, David was in the wilderness, Jonathan came to him, and Jonathan, Saul's son, rose, went to David, and strengthened his hand in God. Isn't that beautiful? Here's your friend David out in the wilderness being pursued by your father the king in desperate straits. You, the crown prince, go out to him the last time you see him and you strengthen his hand in God. Wouldn't you have loved to have been there to hear that conversation? You know what Jonathan said. He said, David, hang in there. David, you're the anointed of God. David, God has his hand on you. David, despite what my father is trying to do, don't lose heart. Great encouragement. Great encouragement. Well, of course, that shows the importance of devotion. The theme of David's life, as we said in our first session together, is that what warms God's heart is not perfection, but devotion. Well, then these are the character traits that God used Jonathan to build into the heart of David. Humility, courage, and loyalty. Warm, gentle, generous spirit, righteousness, and devotion. Isn't that beautiful the way that works? Well, Jonathan, of course, was a Christ-like figure. He saw David and he loved him just as he was. Reminds you of that marvelous passage, Christ loved us when we were yet sinners. He died for us. He gave up everything for him, just as Christ did. Even though he existed in the form of God, Paul said in the letter to the Philippians, he didn't consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but he laid it aside and became a bondservant, sacrificed his riches for us. Have you ever thought that when Christ came into your life and you accepted him, and what a beautiful story this was of that Sheila shared with us this morning of the early morning acceptance of Christ, and so often it happens that way. Have you ever thought that what Christ said to you when he came to you in your wretchedness and your misery was, friend, heaven will not be complete for me unless you were there? That's love. That's love of one friend for another, laying aside and giving up everything. Has God sent a friend like that to you? Do you have a friend like that in your life? And better yet, are you a friend like that in someone else's life? Have you come to the place in your own Christian walk that you're willing to allow God to mold you into a divine instrument, as David was being molded by God, as Jonathan was being used in David's life? Have you come to the place that you're willing to let God use you to build Christ-like qualities into someone else's life? Because that's really what the Christian walk is all about, isn't it? Let me tick off for you in just a couple of minutes four or five things that I think in the way of principles emerge from this passage. Some things we learn from the enemies and the friends of life. First, God never allows a hurt without providing the healing. God never allows a hurt without providing the healing. Whatever the source of the hurt, for healing, God almost always works through people. Now, he can do it directly. He can divinely intervene, but most generally he works through people. Are you willing, if God provides you with the opportunity, just in this coming week, to be God's healing hands in someone's hurting life? God never allows a hurt without providing healing. Second, pressure is God's growth tool, and for his children, the pain is to train and not to punish. Pressure is God's growth tool, and for his children, the pain is to train and not to punish. Third, God brings the lows after the highs to keep us from being carried away. See, we're just like Paul. Paul said, he sent me the thorn in the flesh, what, to keep me from being elevated by so much revelation. God brings the lows after the highs to keep us from being carried away. So if you've had some success, my counsel to you is to duck, because there's a divine haymaker on the way. God usually works it that way, keeps our feet on the ground. Fourth, if you can react to this story of extraordinary friendship, then you're going to react to it in three ways. Way number one is, by golly, I'm going to do that. I am going to go out and I am going to be that kind of a person. I'll be that kind of a friend. And it's 20 minutes to 11. That will last until about 12:05. The second thing you can do is say, that's impossible. I'll never be able to do that, and you can forget it. And then the third thing that you can do is say, it's impossible for me, but all things are possible for God. And say to God, take my life and use it the way you used Jonathan's life. If you can do that, then you'll remember Jonathan and recall that friendship requires initiative, work, cost and risk. Vulnerability. Finally, it requires vulnerability. And that reminds me, as we close, of something C.S. Lewis said about this marvelous ingredient in friendship, which, of course, is love. Jonathan's soul was knit to David's because of love. There's always risk involved in this kind of a relationship. This is what C.S. Lewis said about love. To love it all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it safely in the casket of your own selfishness. And in that casket, safe, dark, airless, motionless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The only place outside heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers of love is in hell. Let's thank God this morning. Father, we just thank you for this beautiful story of the relationship between Jonathan and David. Like David, we have enemies in our lives who tend to wear us down. And like David, if you'll allow it, we trust you, Father, to send friends like Jonathan who will sustain our spirits and lift us up. Help us to be that kind of friend. In Jesus' name, amen.